So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lo.
This week, we have a special treat for you guys. We have an interview with the creator of Tetris and his good friend who helped bring it to the rest of the world. And we've also got a discussion around a few things, that AI development letter that came down, supposedly, from several tech leaders, certainly from Elon Musk, and a whole bunch of other news. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. You can join us Thursday mornings on our YouTube channel around 10:30 a.m. Eastern for a live stream of the show. And you can see our faces, put some, you know, faces to the voices. We sometimes show off gadgets, and we often just talk to the chat room too. So if you want to grab some coffee, sit down with us, it's a fun time. So normally, I feel like we leave interviews on the show towards the end so we can have a good conversation around news and everything, but this is a pretty big one. This week, I got to chat with Alexey Pajitnov and Hank Rogers. Alexey is the guy who created Tetris in the Soviet Union back in the 80s, or was that maybe late 70s? I talked to them both around the new Tetris movie that's coming to Apple TV Plus this weekend. I'll be talking about my thoughts about the movie later on in this episode, and you can read my review over at Engadget. But you know what? We had a great chat around this movie and Tetris's legacy, and I think it's a really interesting discussion. So take a listen. Hank and Alexey, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget Podcast.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. Yes,
it's great. It's amazing. This is a great opportunity. I really enjoyed the movie, guys. It's a ton of fun. My main question just coming out of this, like, what is the craziest thing in the movie that is actually true? Because I feel like some things you can tell were maybe fudged a bit, but what is the wildest thing that you guys experienced?
I would say the craziest thing that happened in the movie is that it doesn't actually show up in the movie, but they got the feeling across, is that I was walking on thin ice. I thought I might end up in a gulag. I had no idea. It was, how can I say, all balls, no brains.
That's a good way to put it. And Alexey, like from your end, you know, it must have been a much bit different experience on your side, and a really dangerous one too. Like any notable things you'd remember from, you know, getting the game out of the USSR?
Well, basically I was all the time I tried to be together with Ilorg. So I consulting with them, and I was the representative of the real owner of the game that time, which was my computer center. So I didn't do much of the risk shown at the screen at that time. But we were strictly forbidden to have any personal or any casual relationship with the foreigner that time. So the fact that I invited this guy for a dinner to my apartment was kind of serious risk. So,
gotcha. Do you regret it now?
Oh, absolutely not. And basically, that was already kind of starting of perestroika time. We have helpful changes in our country and stuff. So I really feel and believe in those stuff. So I did what I did.
I'm glad it worked out for you both. Did either of you have any idea that the game would become so big and honestly have such a lasting appeal too, because people are still discovering Tetris? It's in new forms now. How big do you think it was going to get from the beginning?
Well, when I just designed it, when I just have the very first prototype, with no decoration, with no scoring, just a pure mechanics, I catch myself that already second week I give myself excuse that I'm debugging something, but in reality I'm hooked on it and can't stop playing. So I did realize that this is a really good game, but I never expect anything like that, of course.
Well, I was a publisher for the first year. from the time that I founded a Consumer Electronics Show to the time that I went to Moscow, I was concerned with the Japanese market. And frankly speaking, Spectrum Holobyte and Mirrorsoft, they didn't think they had, you know, a giant hit on their hand. That just never, in fact, everybody at that time, you know, didn't think so. The biggest company in Japan passed on Tetris. They said it was, in 1988, they said it was too retro. And I'm going like, yeah, that's like, oh my goodness. There are so many people who passed on Tetris because they didn't realize how big this thing was going to be. And I guess I didn't.
Hank, can you tell me about your experience just, you know, playing the game for the first time? Was it actually at CES? Like, it's,
yes,
portrayed?
It was
in the movie?
At CES, and it was at the Spectrum Holobyte booth. Gilman Louis is actually Chinese, so he's a quite different character from the movie. But my job was to find games to bring to Japan. So I was going from machine to machine to test all these games and have discussions. Well, I found myself for the fourth time standing in line to play Tetris again. I realized that I was hooked on this game.
Well, you strike me, Hank, as somebody who also understands games and knows games and plays games. And Alexei, too. Like, I'm wondering, what was your experience, Alexei, with computer games before discovering Tetris? Because I feel like it must have been much limited compared to what people could access in the West.
Well, I saw lots of game, and I understand their, well, probably I have kind of natural feeling for the game. So because I feel I really understand the weak and strong parts of every game I tried. It wasn't too much available to me at that time. I do remember playing Q-Bird. I really enjoy Pac-Man, and I remember Centipedes. Then this game, maybe you remember, it's like a snake goes around the
Kicks.
Kicks, yes, something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And you have to make a little box around it.
Yeah, it eats the numbers and enlarge its size.
Oh, no, that's the different.
That's the different one.
I don't know.
Yeah, so my favorite was, and still kind of I'm hyping, the game called Lode Runner. Oh, my goodness. I spent maybe good half a year playing this game.
Seriously?
Yeah, it was my, I think that's the, that time I thought that's ideal game. I do remember it very well. And I'm still get involved time to time. They want me to design the levels for it or whatever. So,
oh, that's fun. Well, you know, I think since the rise of Tetris, I feel like Tetris was the first casual video game that a lot of people, even non-gamers, like really just latched into and ended up spending a lot of time with. Since then, you know, we've had smartphones and mobile gaming has become such a huge thing. Do you guys see kind of a pathway to mobile games and how other companies are kind of exploding games in different ways and kind of what you hit on with Tetris at the beginning?
Well, so for mobile games, when I started my mobile game company, people would buy a game. You know, you'd spend $4.99, right, whatever, the price of a cup of coffee. And now you have to give the games away and bug the people with commercials or ads. It is so annoying. It's like going to the movie and either being nickel and dimed every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so disruptive to a game to have to go through all of that. And so I really feel that we need to get back to a time when people will actually, this is a cup of coffee, you know, and what you, we're going to give you 10 minutes of pleasure from this cup of coffee. We're selling you a game. You're going to have hours and hours and hours of pleasure. You know, give us a little money for that.
It seems old school today to that concept, I guess. Do you think games lose something when a lot of companies are just, you know, here's the game for free, pay us a monthly pass or something? Is it different when a game is presented like that rather than something you buy outright?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And answering your previous question, I'm very much with you about the first casual game. So the very important role of Tetris of that time was that it start to ruin ruining the barrier between people and computers. Ruining the barrier is good for us. So basically, it was a serious barrier that time. And Tetris, something very simple and very amazing and easy appearing on the screen, was very important thing. But many people forget about the other very important moment. Tetris kind of make the game kind of they kind of put the legacy into the game. So I do remember many people feel really embarrassed to admit that they are hooked with my game. But many people say, no, I don't play game, just Tetris. That's an exception. But this was key important exception for the industry. After that, in many people's mind, it kind of switched a little bit that it's okay to play games. And that's give the really serious kind of to the industry.
It kind of opened the floodgates, I think, for a much wider audience. So that's
and Tetris has a big role in it.
I have a question for you guys from James True at Engadget. He's reported a lot about classic Tetris and people playing competitive classic Tetris. He's wondering, and a lot of people in the esports community are wondering, like, is there something holding back classic Tetris, NES Tetris, from becoming a bigger esport? What are your thoughts on that as the Tetris company?
No, I don't think there's anything holding it back, except what we need is a licensee with vision on this. So I think Tetris is the perfect game for esports. And you can see by, you know, how exciting it is to watch people play. So nothing really. I don't run the Tetris myself. My daughter does it now. We're always on.
I loved hearing that, seeing that at the end of the movie, by the way. That is lovely.
Yeah. So, you know, we're always on the lookout for new licensees that have a great idea that want to develop Tetris in some way. Absolutely.
So I really enjoy this competition. If you're following, I even kind of give the first prize on one of them. So I feel that it's almost the ideal platform for such a competition. It's a little bit old-fashioned. It does look new and look a little bit retro. But in terms of playing, what?
No, I'm just saying. Go on. Don't be saying. Don't be.
It's your classic. It's your baby.
Game as being classic and
for very innovative esports stuff, they probably expect something kind of outstanding.
I think we're seeing Gen Z kids and really young kids really going back to the NES and going back to old systems. So. Are you guys supporting the way players still play on old systems, or would you rather be like?
No,
absolutely.
Wherever people want to play Tetris, we support that.
Gotcha. And it's funny how adaptable Tetris is. Like we've seen it become kind of a battle royale. We've seen all sorts of multiplayer options. I'm wondering, for my last question, just looking forward, what is the one thing you guys wanted to achieve with Tetris, but haven't quite got there? Will we ever see like Tetris in augmented reality or something, like giant skyscraper size matches that you're playing through your goggles?
We've already seen both of those. I still haven't seen a Zen Tetris because I believe that the falling blocks and you are playing Tetris puts you into a flow mode. And I want to create a Tetris. I want someone to create a Tetris where it's just like transcendental meditation. Spend 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening, and it settles your mind down. Because when you play Tetris, you have to make quick decisions, and your mind generally doesn't do that. You can go through your whole day without making any decision. What am I going to have? A latte again? This is like you do this from memory. It's a knee-jerk reaction now. But Tetris, you have to like... And so what it does is it occupies some part of your mind, which I think is a pleasure center. And what it does is relaxes you because you can't think about anything else. You have to focus on the Tetris game. And this is what meditation is all about, is to focus your mind on one thing, and then you can mind connect and float.
Oh, for sure. I would say you guys made that game. You guys made the Zen Tetris, because that's how I feel playing Tetris on the Game Boy, to be honest. Well,
it should be recognized, and it shouldn't take more time than it takes for you to do TM in the morning. No, it shouldn't take a half hour or an hour. It should be limited, for each day, so that you can do it again the next day.
Yeah, gotcha. My vision in future, I'm really looking for some kind of real two-player Tetris. I have strange feeling that we are not there yet. So all two-player Tetris kind of falling into solitaire player playing, mm-hmm. because Tetris takes all your resources, all your attention or whatever. You don't have time to react to the other person action or play field or whatever. So something should be invented and done to create really, really strong two-player activity.
MMA Tetris?
What is MMA?
MMA is a mixed
martial arts. I see. That's the rated M version of Tetris, I guess. Yeah. Well, Hank and Alexi, thank you guys so much for chatting with us. And hope to chat with you soon. Good luck with everything. And can't wait to see how people respond to the Tetris.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks again to Alexi and Hank for that chat. And you know what? Let us know your thoughts about Tetris or this movie, because I'm sure many people are going to be watching it this weekend. podcastandgadget.com. Let's move on to some other news. And I feel like the big thing we saw this week, Sherlyn, is this letter that came out from the Future of Life Institute, issued a letter signed by Elon Musk and a whole bunch of other notable people in tech, asking for a 6-month pause on AI development beyond GPT-4. And GPT-4 is the thing that was just recently announced. And I feel like when I first saw this news, I was like, hey, yeah, this is exactly what we're talking about on the Engadget podcast. We've been saying we're kind of hurtling into this stuff too quickly, and maybe we should sit and think back about the ethical and, societal ramifications of all this stuff. What was your first thought about hearing this, Sherlyn? Because it gets more complicated.
I think I saw a lot of the tweets around it, and it was just headline level scrutiny for me. And 6-month pause, it just seems a lot like panic to me. It seems like, oh no, everything. But I wouldn't say it's completely unfounded panic. I think you can tell, obviously, every major tech company is looking into inserting generative AI into their products, and almost willy-nilly just opening it up to the public because of this weird competition to beat each other to the punch. And so I think a pause is warranted in this case, kind of like, hey, sit and think.
Or at least discussion of a pause.
Yeah, mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. that's not a bad idea.
I feel like it sounds reasonable on the face of it, but pretty quickly after this letter dropped, a lot of people were like, hey. Elon Musk does not do anything altruistically. Okay, what is Elon Musk getting out of this?
Yeah, and
then
exactly.
A lot of people started pointing out that, you know what, the OpenAI, the organization, was initially co-founded by Musk. He donated $10 million to them back in 2015. And there was a point, as many articles point out, Forbes has one from Matt Novak, where Elon Musk was getting frustrated with the development of AI at OpenAI. And around 2018, he was basically pushing Sam Altman to take full control of the company, and Musk himself was pushed out by Altman and the board. And actually now whenever I write about OpenAI, and if I mention this thing founded by Musk and Sam Altman, I almost always get a letter from OpenAI saying, hey, Elon Musk is not involved anymore. You don't need to mention him like that, or at least he's not a current person involved with it. But it sounds like Elon Musk, this is the thing where he's like, oh, you guys have actually progressed pretty quickly. And meanwhile, Elon Musk and Tesla are kind of working on their own AI solutions. It's something they need for self-driving, for the robot, for so many other things. This almost seems like one of those things, like a playground game, like, oh man, you're too far ahead. Please slow down. Please slow down so I can catch up. Please. Does it feel like that to you, Sherlyn?
No, more the thought I was about to go on to was that I don't know what a pause is supposed to look like, right? A pause out of control AI experiments. What does that mean? You mean...
It means pause development, right?
Everybody say pause, but are we really sure people are going to stop doing it in the background? Like, you know, just because you're not publicly having or running these AI experiments doesn't mean people are not running, you know, neural nets or machine learning algorithms in the background. No, you can tell me to try to pause. Like, let's hypothetically say this. Oh, nationwide pause on selfies. Okay, sure.
Yeah. Okay. Still well, it's more like selfies. It's weirdly like not even is the thing. Like he's saying pause on development beyond GPT-4, the thing you're so great at. That does not mean Tesla and other companies are pausing on their AI that is not up to the level of GPT-4. It is basically saying, hey, give us time to catch up, guys. Can we play fair here? There has been a lot of response from people actually in the AI community who I think kind of break all this down pretty well. My favorite thread is from Ali Al-Khatib, who points out, number one, lots of trash interspersed in the letter, which is true. The letter sort of, it paints the sort of like doomsday scenario of AI potentially like destroying humanity and doing bad things. And Ali and other people have pointed out like the AI right now is already bad. It's already potentially causing harm. So maybe we should focus on that. Point two, the org is bad. This company, this organization, the Future Institute, it is a long-termism company. It's one of those organizations that is always talking about like humanity, what humanity needs to do to prepare for the future, make as much money as possible so you can spend it on things in the future or be ready for the future. We've talked about this before. Not really a great, I would say, social philosophy right now. Ali also points out lots of false signatories on the letter. Bill Gates did not actually sign it. It seemed like it was kind of just open for everybody to sign it. And the other main thing, he says, wake me up when there's a letter that doesn't center a bunch of old white dudes who got rich on this tech. That's it. Drop mic scenario. Knowing like the actual community response to this, Sherlyn, like, how do you see this letter? And like, do you think how do we actually have this societal conversation and this like ethical, I don't know, interrogation about AI?
I think the fact that there were people like straight up pretending to be Bill Gates signing this thing shows you, I'm like, yeah, no, this thing is sus. It's to quote Married at First Sight Australia, the recap show this is suso. It's very suspicious. And I'm just not convinced about the motivations. I think all the part you referenced, it's a very good point, right? I also want to point out KP in our live stream chat also says, like, pause, how? Kind of like going back to the thing we were talking about earlier.
How does that work?
Is it a 6-month vacation for employees at OpenAI? Like, is that what they're talking about? So it is very suspicious. The motivations don't seem sound. It is, however, I think their motivations might not have been sound, but the output isn't a bad one. The idea isn't a bad one to kind of take a breather. What that looks like, I don't know. I think maybe more of panels and conversations around the ethical side of things, or like limiting a lot of these like open to the public types of experiments. And figuring that out.
Maybe don't immediately start rolling it out into all of your products, like, immediately, I guess.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the thing. Microsoft's you get some AI. Office, you get AI. Microsoft cybersecurity tools.
Yeah. As has Google, right? Like, it's both of them. It's both of them adding it into their entire suite of, like, Office/productivity tools. And then I think other big names are coming up with more, too. So we're just like, yeah, it's getting out of hand a little too fast. It feels like one person said we can do this and everyone's like, we have to do this too. It's a competition thing that doesn't feel right.
It's a weird race. Like, yeah. And we've talked about this before. It's sort of like the entire tech world has been waiting for the next big thing. Like, we had smartphones, right? Wearables were never quite the thing. Wearables were interesting and big. Not as big as like the iPhone, right? And we're still waiting for that iPhone moment. And it feels like, as we've discussed it, like, AI is legit that thing that can transform how we use tech and our society. But it also feels like we are rushing into, we're already on like the iPhone 5 version of AI without like thinking about like how this stuff is actually interacting with us. So anyway, we'll be following all this. That letter is a really fun thing to look into now, just in terms of like thinking about the motivations behind it. And Yeah, read about long-termism and the potential harm that could be doing to us, because it's a whole... We talked about this around Sam Bankman-Fried, Zhirlin. Like, do you remember that discussion?
Yes. It's very weird. This was Binance? No, this was a FTX, thank you.
That fell apart. Binance also fell apart around that time.
Yes.
So that is why you're thinking about that.
Exactly.
But yeah, it is the idea, it's the philosophy of focusing on like the future impact of future humans, seemingly ignoring the humans who exist right now who need a lot of help.
I will say this, mm-hmm. right? I think that with a lot of trends and a lot of fads, I think you'll notice that we as people covering the developments in the industries can tell if something is moving too fast with no real like direction. So wearables is like, everyone was jumping on the wearables train. Everyone was jumping on this, you know, crypto. Oh my God, all the most annoying people were jumping on crypto, blockchain, all that stuff.
And a lot of money was involved.
Right.
There, so that
and
it was a thing.
It was,
yeah.
Exactly. There was a lot of money. I'm not saying it was a pipe, but there's a lot of this stuff that came and everyone hyped up really hard, at least in recent memory. I know that I was like extremely skeptical about how quickly it would take over, how the mainstream audience would take to it. I think though with AI, I'm just like, this is groundbreakingly different. It's going to impact all of us in a bigger way than crypto could ever. So
We all have like a spidey sense, right? Like I feel like all the tech reporters and people following the technology industry, some people just want to make money, right? Some people just want to make money from like speculative futures and what crypto could mean or what what NFTs really are. And some people are just like, well, you know, they're trying to make bank on whatever the next big thing is. I do feel like not to toot our own horn, but we kind of have a sense of like, oh man, this feels bad and this feels weird. So anyway, we're gonna be following all of that. And in other news, it feels a little iffy and weird. As we were discussing things last week during our last episode, TikTok CEO, as we talked, Shou Chu was testifying before Congress. That was going on for a while, and it was not a very pretty sight. I saw some people asking him, like, does TikTok access our Wi-Fi? Like, their Wi-Fi in their home? Like, yeah, dude.
It's an app that goes on
the internet. Uh-huh. What does someone it explain?
Well, someone made a joke in response to a tweet I made about joining group chats or not, and the tweet was saying, "Oh, does joining a group chat connect to your home Wi-Fi?" I did not get it until you just explained this.
That is the joke, and I forget the TikTok CEO response, but it was a little like, yeah, that's how this works. It's sort of. I remember when somebody was asking Zuckerberg, how does Facebook make money? And it was like, Zuckerberg was like, we distribute ads. You know, that is the thing that's going on. One thing we want to quickly mention is two different things, the Data Act and the Restrict Act, both of which are kind of spinning up right now. We've actually talked about the Data Act before, because that was the legislation we were saying could give President Biden the power to block TikTok. And I'm reading from Lawfare blog right here. I'm just going to read a direct quote because I think they explained it well. The Data Act would provide the president with more authorities to block transactions associated with the import or export of American sensitive data, in quotes, where there are national security risks. There's also the Restrict Act, and that's something you've probably heard a bit about, too. That was introduced on March 7th, and that is the one where people are talking about it could potentially make VPNs illegal, or at least that was the like discussion around it, because I think people just started reading the act and started maybe misinterpreting some rules around it. Turns out that's not actually true. The Daily Dot has a great explainer. It's called, "You will not be jailed for 20 years if you use TikTok after it's banned, despite internet fear-mongering." What seems to have been happening is a lot of like crypto bros. People have been reading parts of this bill. Things are getting shared around out of context. It doesn't seem like this will jail you just for using a VPN, but potentially if that VPN is based in China, you know, like a lot of the fear mongering around these things, like then potentially you may have to find something else. The actual fines and everything just seem entirely made up. So there's a lot of things going on here. It does seem like politically, Sherlyn, both Democrats and Republicans are sort of down with the idea of banning TikTok or adding more controls. AOC has had her own response too, which she posted on TikTok. Love it. But she was more like, we need national privacy laws. That's what we need. We need data protection. We need actual privacy stuff. What is your take on all this?
fully agree with what AOC said. I think that AOC made a very good point, which is that TikTok's just one app and it sets a precedent. There's so many different apps that could be surveilling you, whether or not they're from China. This is a problem. Like, yes, China could be insidious.
As it is a problem person,
I'm telling you, as a Singaporean person, the Chinese government is like something we openly talk about in Singapore, where like there's a lot of corruption that goes on in China. We're like, whatever. And so I'm not like in defense of China here, but who like Russian apps could also be spying on you if there's, you know, there any is ever as big one as
Everything is kind of blocked from Russia.
Everyone. So AOC's point being that like it's not about, you know, this one app. It's about having a dedicated, I guess, committee that has regulations and people who are informed about these issues being on the board, as opposed to people who don't even know how home Wi-Fi works grilling the TikTok CEO.
Which is what happens every time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
When Zuckerberg was up there, people were asking him about their apps too, right?
Their emails iPhones, or why are my emails not being seen or something, right? There was something like that.
Mm-hmm. Say what you will about GDPR and those annoying cookie requests we get on many websites, but that legislation has pushed a lot of companies to think harder about how they're collecting people's data and using people's data. I think the broader point is the TikTok ban misses the point when we should be doing the same sort of like protections for users across Facebook and Google and everybody too.
What are you going to ban every ad that you're uncomfortable with moving forward? Because again, this would set a precedent. Again, I do not use TikTok. I do not give a crap if it gets banned or not. It doesn't impact my personal life, but it's the precedent
you don't,
setting.
You don't use TikTok? Are you still anti? Like, yeah, I do recall, like, you were not hot on TikTok early on. You were definitely anti TikTok for a while. So I'm trying to get to the heart of that.
Yeah, I know. I'm not anti. I just don't. I have it on my phone. I don't use it. It's not sucked me in, I guess, right? It's not one of the things I scroll every day. I maybe like go into play with some of the filters that I saw online. And
yeah, the filters are
pretty
fun.
Much it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think also we saw Senator Josh Hawley also try to just like straight up introduce a TikTok ban. It was Rand Paul who kind of struck him down, which is a very weird thing. As producer Ben points out, the worst person you know just made a really good point. I never want to praise Rand Paul, but here we go. So anyway, that is a whole thing. And it's a bit of dry news, but we are seeing a lot of things like come up as people talk about a TikTok ban. And personally, it just feels like to me that misses the point, even though, yes, we should be worried about what all these companies are doing, especially a Chinese company is doing with our data. I still use TikTok every day. My daughter, that is kind of the thing I use to just chill with my daughter before bath time or something, where we just watch her videos. It's very cool and cute, and it is less of a lift than YouTube, which is, I think, the big thing. Like, we keep talking about, like, oh, the ease of access for content is the thing that makes it happen. And with TikTok, you know, you open it up and you're getting videos recommended to you. And that is the main thing. Ben asking, what's up?
I was going to say, I am now reminded of a documentary from, I think it was Tribeca last year that we talked about called TikTok Boom, right? And it's just reminding me now that, like, again, this was a lot, like, I remember at the time, it was a fine documentary. It did take too many artistic liberties. It did bend facts a lot, and I did not enjoy that part of it. And, like, this is the danger of, like, not being very good about your facts, about, like, as a documentarian. I wonder how many people actually saw the documentary and was like, oh, God. Like, again, TikTok is something that, like, could be very insidious, but also not to the point where this documentary straight up said this thing is scanning your face and looking at your expressions and then tweaking its algorithm. I'm like, you wouldn't know if your camera was turned on.
Depends. We will talk about spyware that can do that.
We can talk about that. If it's bypassing the indicator, it's not supposed to. This should be system level status indicators about access to
There's a lot of weird
cameras.
Fear mongering in that thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a slippery slope.
I will say, like, I don't know. We haven't really like fully talked about TikTok yet, but I think it is a really interesting app, sort of like an offshoot of like what was so good about Vine, but really easy, quick videos that people are doing a lot of really cool creative stuff with it. To me, that is the thing. It's like these platforms that people can express themselves more on and more easily, I think, are really fascinating. Ben is asking, is my algorithm trained for Sophia safe videos, videos safe for my daughter? Do I ever get inappropriate videos? It is mostly good. Like, it's mostly like cute animal stuff. She's really into like these like weird gardens, the sort of like self-contained gardens where people put little things together. So I think I'm gonna have to get her one of those eventually. Occasionally I have to skip away from, like, you know, if people are swearing, it's never anything too scary. There are some of those, like, weird horror, like mini horror movie things, and I've just kind of trained those away. So, you know, and TikTok does have a restricted mode, which kind of filters out a lot of explicit stuff too. But yeah, your algorithm kind of suits you. What's up, Sherlyn? What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say that TikTok is also, you know, dangerous in the sense that, like, in the same way Instagram Reels and Instagram was dangerous for our you know, self-esteem and all of that stuff, all the social issues around that, TikTok is getting, as more and more people use it, getting more and more influential on how people, young people, impressionable people view their bodies, view their self-worth. And, you know, a lot of talk around how the filters there are just a little too real at this point. It's all worth looking at. Although it's, I would say that's not,
they're,
similar to the issue of banning an app like TikTok. That's not a TikTok only issue. This is like, we would be like, if we said ban Instagram or ban TikTok because it's causing teens to have self-esteem problems, it's the same thing here. If you're saying TikTok should be banned because of privacy issues, you're ignoring the larger issue and focusing on the one player for sure, this bigger game.
We should do an episode on that at some point, because I'm also seeing, like, interesting pushback from research that's saying that may not be as true as we initially thought. Like, people were scaling back, like, teen suicide rates and teen rates before the 2000s. And
it's also
interesting. There was a big drop after the 90s, and it wasn't necessarily, like, the rise wasn't necessarily related to social apps. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about, but that's definitely a good point. So yeah, we will be talking about that at some point. I briefly mentioned the spyware thing. You know, Sherlyn, yeah, apps aren't supposed to, you know, use your front-facing camera without the indicator or something, but some can. And these are from things called commercial spyware. And it's software that intelligence agencies and other countries usually buy to do nefarious things on your phone, such as when your phone is on sleep, it could be listening to your audio. Or if you're, yeah, it could just turn on your webcam without the indicator. We did see news, the Biden administration they're banning federal agencies from using commercial spyware. So that's stuff from, like, the NSO group, which we've talked about before. This is more like high level intelligence stuff. This is not like the spyware that just, like, is trying to take over your computer to, you know, generate money with ads or something. This is stuff being used to fully just spy on people, like literally spy on people. We've done some coverage around this. I've written about the Alex Gibney documentary about commercial spyware as well. This stuff is dangerous. It does feel like you could do so much with it. We've seen China, actually, that is a big thing the Chinese government is doing to hack into U.S. systems. And we've seen several reports of that. Biden is saying the federal agencies can't use it. That doesn't mean some covert ones won't end up using them somehow. It's just kind of the public facing statement. Any thoughts, Sherlyn?
I mean, covert agencies are going to do what covert agencies are going to do. What they do. Like, the NSA is going to keep spying on you if they want to, and they're going to, like, claim Patriot Act or whatever.
Well, they don't need to buy commercial spyware.
Yeah, they're already the ones
making their own. Yeah,
yeah, it's already made.
Yeah,
they're in the air. You know what I mean? I think C in the chat makes a good point. Everyone needs to trust themselves and live a life of bravery and freedom. I think the point that C is making here is that, like, I'm at a point where maybe I shouldn't feel this way, and maybe I shouldn't, you know, I should demand better. But I'm at a point where, like, I'm like, all right, you want to spy on me? Spy on me. Like, I'm a very boring person. I think for the most part, right, I don't have a lot of sensitive information that needs to be, like, stolen other than credit card info or whatever. Now, I'm not saying that everyone needs to be that way. I'm just saying that I'm not. I don't care. Spy on me. Go ahead. I already live my life like I'm in the Truman Show. So.
You're already posting way too much. So.
Yeah. I'm already like, here, have more of me. You want me? Have more of me. It's out there. And then, you know.
I mean, that is certainly an attitude. I'm certainly, like, I'm not worried about TikTok spying on me or doing location data or something. But if I were working in a government agency, and if my location could reveal something that could be potentially, like, useful to the Chinese government, then I'd be thinking quite.
Absolutely.
Twice. And yeah,
there are people for whom agencies, like, this stuff is definitely a big problem. Like, you don't want to be tracked. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be, like, you're doing whatever. It's your life. But yeah, by and
we
large,
be aware of all threats. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, OK, we've got some other news that is less, less exciting, I guess. But we did see a report. How do you feel about the core of Windows, Sherlyn? The core of Windows 12. Does that sound exciting to you? Like spyware?
I want to go work my core.
You want to work hardcore? I do. I mean, listen. Okay. So Windows Central had this report. Microsoft is working on something called Core PC that could end up showing up in Windows 12, which is a way to sort of like kind of break apart the way Windows works right now. So Windows is an old school OS. Windows 11 still has to work with apps that were written for Windows 95 and Windows 98. There are a lot of like old school apps that still work within Windows. When you install Windows, the actual system folders and everything are on the same drive and the same partition as your files on most laptops on something. Like, unless you're making your own drive partitions or doing that, that leaves everything pretty exposed. That makes it really hard to update the system compared to the way iOS or Android works. So Core PC is this idea, according to this report, for Microsoft to kind of like break that up, put Windows, the system, the OS itself on a separate partition. It would allow them to potentially scale Windows 12 to different sorts of devices too. Sort of like if they want to have a Chromebook competitor, they could have a super light version of Windows. You know?
How many times have we heard of the Windows-powered Chromebook competitor? How many times have we heard about this?
They exist. They totally exist. There are... So this report also says this is sort of like what Microsoft was trying to do with Windows 10X. That is the sort of like... failed a plan to create like a lighter Windows for dual screen devices that didn't end up happening. Actually, it seems like Microsoft is going the other direction. So we saw Windows RT, you know, we saw all these ways for Microsoft to build Windows for ARM chips, a really restricted version of the OS. It sounds like they're kind of going, rather than being from the most restrictive and moving on from there, they're trying to go from supporting everything but sort of restricting how apps and things can access the system. So kind of interesting. And part of this news too, it looks like Microsoft is thinking about baking security into, baking AI into security for like the, for IT providers. So that's something interesting as well. Hey man, AI everywhere, Windows 12. Are you ready for Windows 12, Sherlyn? Like, you're so exciting.
Fix Windows 11 first. Come on. No,
I feel like I still feel like Windows 11. It's weird that came and went and is a thing now. And I'm looking down and my start menu, you know, my taskbar is in the center of my screen. That's the only evidence that we've moved on from Windows 10. Yeah.
It's nice. The search is thankfully not too effed on new computers that shipped with Windows 11. But when I upgraded to Windows 11, like I used to do this, my workflow, right? Start button, a few letters of the app I'm looking for. So start button AUD for Audacity, right? Now on the older laptop that I had that just upgraded to Win 11, as opposed to the laptop that came with Win 11, now when I do that, it just disappears. The start menu does not like trigger the search at all. And then I have to retype and then it always types the wrong thing in again. It's just so bad.
Windows, like, a fresh Windows 11 install can be really nice and snappy, but it does degrade pretty quickly. Windows 12, it is weird. It does feel like Windows 10 did not have enough of a lifespan, but I guess time just moved quickly and we barely even noticed.
I mean,
Sherlyn,
if 12 is on the horizon, isn't Windows 11 going to have a shorter lifespan? Like 10?
Windows 11 is going to have the shortest lifespan. I don't understand the numbering or anything anymore. Anyway, let's move on. There was another story, Sherlyn, you want to talk about. Google unveiled an AI-powered planning tool or tools to help beat climate change's extreme heat. A subhead here is that they'll spot heat islands, track tree canopy coverage, and push useful information in emergency notifications. What's up? Because you're the Googler and you love what Google always does, Sherlyn.
I don't. Okay. So this is part of like Google's things that they do or you know, roll out out of nowhere. You know, it used to be that they did earthquake detection with phones. They would do a lot of they did crash detection earlier as well. They made a very pointed dig at Apple at One.io and Pixel event where, you know, Google Apple added that feature to all its phones. I think it was last year. But this is, you know, one of those things. Like Google knows it has a lot of data, knows it can use that data for good, I guess, and wants to target things like natural disasters, climate change, and this is part of that. I think we shouldn't get too hung up on the idea that this is AI powered. I think, yes, AI is a very buzzy catchphrase right now, or buzzy.
Everything is AI powered.
AI powered.
Go look at so many entrepreneur profiles on Twitter now. The people that were .eth are now like AI. I'm an AI founder.
Oh, of course. Those are the so-called early adopters. They're just a bandwagon abandoners. Tree canopy is part of this. It just shows you kind of, where it uses like high-res aerial images to kind of understand better what the tree canopy is in certain areas. And then it can display that on a map if you're using the Google Environmental Insights Explorer. That information is helpful.
This is more for cities and this is more for civil servants and actual consumers, but
right. It's not. Exactly. That these are tools that are not really for a lot of average users like you and me. I just wanted to point out that Google had a slate of announcements that our AI reporter, Andy Tarantola, helped cover. I do want to say there are more interesting things that came out this week and more, I think, firmly in our wheelhouse. For example, Apple announced that WWDC this year, Worldwide Developer Conference, is taking place June 5th. So I guess I'll be there. I don't know yet. I don't have my invite that I know of yet.
You will probably be there, surely.
I will almost definitely be there.
You will probably be there. I am hoping to be there. I'm just putting that out because this is the rumored one where the VR headset, where their first headset is going to be shown off. So that could be interesting. There were also reports around MacBook changes potentially and them talking about the new chips, so.
Yeah, that would be a squarely you event, and I would be there to be cute.
They always talk about macOS and iOS, so there's always stuff.
I'm always there for iOS and Wear OS. There's usually a lot of OS stuff for me to cover. So that's good to know, because then I can make my travel plans. I've got some in between May and June stuff I want to do.
Better than 5 days before the event. Please fly across the country. Thank you, Microsoft.
Microsoft. Mm-hmm. Oh, unlike them. Yes, exactly. It's so nice to have some heads up. Yes. These are developer conferences. They have to let the developers know ahead of time to start buying tickets, that sort of stuff. Another piece of news this week is we learned that Overdrive is shutting down on May 1st. I don't know if you've ever heard of Overdrive, those of you tuning into the podcast, but it's one of those ebook lending or library apps. And I used to use Overdrive. It was powered by Rakuten, or it was part of Rakuten, who is affiliated with the company that makes the Kobo e-readers. And
Rakuten basically owns Kobo. Yeah, that's the thing.
That's right. Yeah. And so that's how I knew of Overdrive. And I had a lot of books that I borrowed through there. You can use your local library card on Overdrive to get books. Here's the thing. When there's a much better app around, like Libby, it's not really you're losing, right, to Libby. So Libby is my preferred ebook library app. I can use multiple library cards on there. I adore the interface. It looks nice. The good news in all of this is that Overdrive, when you use it now, it will automatically redirect to Libby.
Libby.
Right? That's conceding. It's conceding that... Yeah.
It's a reminder, by the way, that you can borrow ebooks from your library, folks. So go get your library cards, and you don't have to buy all the little books. I just got a Kobo reader, and because I was tired of having Kindles for a while, so I just wanted to see what that experience was like. It's very nice. It's very cute. It's nice to. I just miss e-readers. I miss the e-ink, and my Kobo is beautiful. I love it.
The good news is, since you just bought your Kobo device, a Rakuten spokesperson explained to Engadget or us that switching from Overdrive to Libby on their end anyway, it will not affect you as a user on the library browsing, borrowing, and reading experience on Kobo e-readers.
That's good. That's good to hear. In other news, Disney's reportedly shutting down its Metaverse division. Marielle Moon writes for Engadget. Wrote for us just saying... there was a story that from the Wall Street Journal that Disney shut down its Metaverse division, laid off all the team's 50 or so members as part of a restructuring process. We have Disney is laying off a ton of workers right now, I believe up to 7,000. It's a large amount of workers, and that is the process of what's happening right now. It sounds like this Metaverse division is going away as a thing. But so many times what happens, that doesn't mean they're not going to work in the Metaverse anymore. It just means you don't need this whole big segment of your company doing it. I feel like we don't actually talk about the Metaverse anymore. And I don't think that's a real priority.
That was another hype train.
Except Meta. That was another hype train.
Yeah.
And it's really Meta went way too far. It was like, we're changing our name. We're banking on the future of the Metaverse. And Maybe you called that shot too early, Zuck. I don't know. Do you have thoughts about Disney shutting this down, Trillin?
I was like, oh, they had a Metaverse division? Okay.
They had a Metaverse division. Yeah. I mean, it does kind of... Isn't going to a Disney theme park, you're entering a Metaverse.
Right.
Like you're using a bracelet to tag into things. Reality disappears. You're surrounded by Disney characters. That you could go to the Star Wars thing and live an entirely different planet, apparently.
I think what you're describing tells
Disney
us
is the king
more
of the Metaverse. Yeah.
I think it tells us more that people will always prefer an in-person experience as opposed to sitting at home or standing around at home with a VR headset on. I think I would always prefer going on an actual roller coaster ride than being on a fake one in VR. So Disney,
yeah,
focus
but you can
on
do the
parks.
Fake one from your office. You know, it's fun.
No, I get nausea. Julio, our live stream producer, points out, I just want a video game where I can do my grocery shopping and I can get a virtual experience over using my phone or going in real life. And then I'm assuming, Julio, you mean it would deliver to your door after you go around picking up fruits. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And you would virtually drive the delivery car to your door while you just have to sit in your office.
Oh my God. You're getting Julio way too excited. Julio's like, yes.
No. Never want to leave my house again. There are so many other good grocery options too, Julio.
Can you imagine sitting in your wheeled your office chair with the wheels on it, right? And then going, choo-choo, that's a train. Choo-choo. Beep, vroom vroom beep.
Looking as an aside, if you guys are looking for good grocery solutions, I've really been liking Misfits Market.
I love Misfits Market. Yeah.
It's very cute. It's very like, hey, we have local stuff, pick your stuff, we're gonna send you a box full of stuff, that's it, that's all. Goodbye. Yeah. It's not like you're not worrying about the Instacart person going around the store. And is this the right thing? Is that?
I love you screaming at the user like you're like an old dad. Hey, we have stuff. Bye.
Literally, the Misfits Market box is a pile of stuff. They don't put it in bags. It's just like all your fruit, all your veggies all together. Here's a box for cold stuff. It is the best online grocery thing I've seen so far. And I don't feel bad about it because it doesn't involve like a minion doing the grunt work that Julio wants to do virtually, you know? So, hey, that's kind of cool. Let's move on to stories from around in gadgets. We've got a bunch of this stuff this week. Nathan Ingram finally got to review the new Sonos, what do you call it? The spatial audio
era.
Speakers.
Yeah.
Era 300 and Era 100. The Era 300 got a score of 80. It seems like it sounds good, but he's not fully sold on the like spatial audio-ness of it. The Era 100 got a score of 88, and Nate says it improves on the Sonos One in just about every way, and I am very intrigued by the Era 100. So what do you, you were thinking about getting speakers at some point, Trillin. Like, are you looking at any of these, either of these?
My main problem with the speakers that I currently own is the Bluetooth sync. Not Bluetooth sync, the Wi-Fi sync. So sometimes
the
they're
sync.
Not good. But,
oh, yeah.
But
you will not have that problem on Sonos. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I might look into these.
The one good thing about Sonos is that they're syncing and they're like multi-room syncing is like rock solid. So, yeah, this would be the thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I meant more them staying connected to my Wi-Fi, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Yeah.
We'll see. I'm intrigued by the Era 100 just because I do like the idea of cheaper speakers. It is $250, but Nate says it sounds pretty good. And for people who are running current Sonos setups, like we've talked about this before, but if you have a Sonos Arc, if you're lucky enough to have the Sonos Arc soundbar, that is a Dolby Atmos thing. These Era things, having them as your rear speakers would be a huge kind of improvement there. Sounds really cool. And other stuff around a gadget, Carissa Bell wrote about Reki's smart snow goggles that sort of add AR. They add an AR view on top of, you know, your goggles while you're on the slopes. This is something I have never done, will probably never do, but it seems cool, judging from the promo video they put up there.
So like there's a promo video. I edited this piece, and I can tell you a little bit more. Carissa's describing it was so funny. So, okay, there's a little like 1-inch-ish screen above the nose bridge area that you can keep looking up at. And it tells you things like your, you know, distance traveled, elevation. It's got features that can tell you where your friends are and how far away they are from you if they're also wearing these goggles. Yeah. So for Carissa, who goes skiing with her husband a bunch, For her, she was like, she tends to like zoom down the slope, whereas her husband kind of takes his time. So she'll be like at the bottom of the slope waiting for him to catch up, and she can see his number tick down towards her, which is nice, right? And then, yeah, exactly. And then it's also when you can use the screen to see your notifications sometimes, which I don't think a lot of people will be doing while they're zooming down a slope. But you can also just turn everything off and just have it display the time. So it's a clock, right? And according to Carissa, this line in her article really made me laugh. She goes, it's better to than like, you know, constantly taking out your phone, or she doesn't wear a watch, so it's not, or also better than stupidly shouting, Siri,
hey Siri,
tell me the, yeah, sorry, tell me the time, sorry, especially when you're like scrolling, again, surrounded by wind noise. You're like, hey Siri, what time is it? The mental
sorry
image
for everybody who's been activated after from all the shouting. There's
yeah,
a video
not to say that,
article
yeah.
that that kind of shows this. The actual display is very stupid simple. Like it is simple pixel graphics. It's like it is a black and white pixel display that just shows you stuff. You see the battery meter. It looks like an old school watch, you know, or an old smartwatch. yeah. Kind of useful. I have friends who are crazy enough to love the cold and the winter and the snow, and they have been waiting for smart stuff like this. So it seems that this is a sort of like good use of augmented reality, because you're doing something that's really physically demanding and you're getting information and you don't have to like make life harder for yourself. This is useful stuff. So I want to see more stuff like this. What is the sort of like, you do a lot of working out, Trillin. Do you want a heads up display like goggles that will track your movement and the speed of your fists as you're hitting the punching bag?
I don't want to wear anything on my face when I'm working out, unfortunately. So on my watch, though, it's been helpful when I do my HIIT workouts every
year.
Well, okay, we have cardio days and strength days. On strength days, it doesn't really matter. On strength days, it would be nice if like I was working out on my own to count my reps. That's something I'm still waiting for. I think some devices do that, but not very accurately. On cardio days, you wanna see your heart rate. So like that's where the Apple Watch has come in very handy lately, where I can see very clearly. I'm like peak heart rate, like max heart rate. Like, okay, good. To have it on a heads up display would be nice, but I wonder if it might be distracting. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah.
It might be. So it depends. Again, I don't wear anything on my face when I'm working out. If there's some other way to have the information in my eyeballs all the time, it'd be great. I'd be like, oh, okay, 12 reps, stop now. Like, you know, but my trainers would never let me stop at 12. You know,
it would
always
be cool
rogue.
If like, yeah,
yeah.
You could have like a virtual fight or something, or virtual training, like battle
yeah.
with somebody.
There's
like,
a lot of, there's so many.
It was good enough for that. Yeah,
there's a lot of good like VR workouts that I can't wait for.
Yeah,
us
but
to
the
dive
VR
into.
Headsets, like
and that's
I've
the problem.
VR, yeah, the VR headsets are so big, but if you could have just the goggles and get like this, the version of somebody in front of you, get like Mr. I'll mention John Wick 4 later, but if you could get Mr. Donnie Yen to be in front of you, and, like,
or
you
like
practice,
the or like that episode know. Of Black Mirror, the Street Fighter one.
The Street Fighter one is really cool, but that one is more straight up VR. But, you know, yeah, that one also goes places. Let's move on to what we're working on. I reviewed Acer's glasses-free 3D gaming laptop, the Predator Helios 300 Spatial Labs Edition. I did not like it. So
yeah, I heard.
Go read my review about that.
Our score is 59, y'all. It's
our score is
one
59.
Of our lowest scores, yeah.
This is a point where I did have to tell Acer, like, hey, I'm so sorry, but this sucks. Let me know when it's better, because it's glasses-free 3D, and the whole thing about that, you've probably experienced some of these, Sherlyn, is when it has to track your eyes, it's also spitting out two images at the same time, so they're using like these polarized displays that are projecting two things simultaneously. They're both being spit into your eyes at slightly different angles to give you a sense of depth, and for me, that is just like headache. That is trying to focus on a magic eye puzzle while also playing God of War or something, or racing in Forza Horizon 5. And it's not really fun. It is weird. It kind of distracts from the experience. I think like some of it worked well. Like God of War looked like there was more depth. It was kind of cool. But this laptop is limited to a 4K 60 hertz screen. It doesn't go to the high refresh rates you want in a gaming system, even though it has some decent hardware. It starts at $3,500, and I'm just like, why does this exist? I understand why Acer does this stuff for like professional computers. Maybe somebody working with 3D models would want to pay for this tech to do some weird 3D stuff. But no, gamers, no, nobody needs this. Put on a 3D headset, put on a VR headset if you want to see some 3D models, and it would still look better. So was not a fan. This is one of those weird experiments. Acer tends to do this. They did that. They did a gaming laptop with the weird hinge. The screen would just like flip all the way around. I reviewed that. Did not like that very much either.
The swivel one? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Acer loves to try new things. I'm just like, buddy, calm down. Just give me an inexpensive and powerful gaming laptop, and I think that is good. Sherlyn, what are you working on?
So I'm still close to finishing the Halo Rise review, y'all. It's going to be up this week or next, so that's great.
Has it been months? You've been talking about this for months.
Weeks, maybe 1.5 months of being on my working on. Yeah. It's we're shooting the video today, which means the video will go up on Monday, and the written part is basically done too. So we're just gonna it's coming. The reason it got sidetracked a little is we spent quite a lot of time this week shooting this new video. It's coming out tomorrow. I cannot wait for y'all to see it. This year at Engadget, we're doing a few different things with our videos. We're trying to be a little bit more thoughtful about our approach and have more fun. Hopefully the result is more entertaining videos for you. Yeah, and I can't wait for you to watch this. This is a video we're calling Breaking Bard. It's fun. Wow. It was fun. Wow. So
I do wonder what that's going to be about. Sounds cool. Okay.
If you have had questions about AI and the limits of the Bing and Bard chatbots as they stand today, tomorrow, go look at our YouTube channel. I've already watched the finished video. I'm excited. This is fun. It was good. We got an email from Katie about Google Bard. Katie was also playing around with Google Bard and using it to do some iPhone comparisons. And she sent along a screenshot saying that, you know, Google Bard is definitely drunk, kind of like in reference to our previous episode. So thank you. I want to say thank you, Katie, for sending the email. And as a reminder to everyone listening and watching, you can send us emails, podcast@engadget.com. We love getting your emails. I also just saw that we got an email from someone, just asking if our two separate podcast feeds for the morning edition podcast versus the weekly one, were they somehow mixed up. So we are going to look into that. Apparently there's a Google Podcast issue that we will look into. We also got another email from someone recently that I can't remember off. Oh no, I didn't get another email. I got a shout from a fellow Singaporean, a Singaporean listener of the Engadget podcast, which was nice. Thanking me for the correct pronunciation for the CEO of TikTok, which was
it's just really it's nice just really you all like getting very annoyed about it too. Yeah.
Right. We Singaporean people are like, is he a good representative of
has
us?
To be right.
Is he? No.
That's cool. Okay, so let's move on to our pop culture picks. What do you have this week?
So again, picks. This was always just Engadget picks, not pop culture picks. Today, I don't have a pop culture.
Whatever, man.
Yeah.
What's your pick?
No pop culture pick for y'all. So I think people who follow me on Instagram or Twitter know that I've been dealing with some mental health, self-esteem, whatever sort of issues lately. It's been hard, and a good motivational Instagram post can really help. So today I am recommending, there's so many out there, you can follow whoever you want. I've found We The Urban, the Instagram account We The Urban, to be kind of like nice. It's got daily sort of affirmations. I don't know if you call them affirmations. They're just daily reminders. It's like 9 things you need to, or maybe you, like, it's like someone needs to hear this today is the cover image, or like 9 things to know today. And then it will like give you some reminders of, you know, how to not to be too harsh on yourself, or like, you know, value your own self. It's okay to put up, you know, boundaries if you need. It's really nice. The graphics are also very aesthetic, very clear, very straightforward, but you know, when the power of the message is the words, then it doesn't need to be too fancy schmancy. So I was actually going to talk about something else too, which I only thought about last night. So we don't have video for this necessarily, but there is this new series on Netflix called Wellmania, and it stars, or it's from Celeste Barber, who is known for her Instagram content making fun of celebrities. I think her Instagram is hilarious. However, the series I have heard is cringe. So yeah, that's sad. But
there's a fine line between social media, like, you know, mastering it and true cringe. And
yeah,
it's a shame.
So the funny thing is that I came across this from, because my gym, the gym I go to is F45. So F45 is an Australian thing. Celeste Barber is also Australian. So there was like a team up. So yesterday we were all
in class.
What is
F45? Can you explain this? What is going on? Because when you and Matt Smith start talking about fitness stuff, I'm like, what language are you speaking? What is going on?
I know. F45 stands for functional 45. Basically, it's like 45-minute classes of whatever. Sometimes it's strength. Sometimes it's cardio. Sometimes it's hybrid.
45 minutes, man.
Yeah, and it's all circuits. It's all circuit-based. So it's like three sets of 40 seconds on, rests of 20 seconds in between. Or sometimes it's 55-second long sets, and those are terrible. So then there's these big displays in front of the class, and you look at what to do, and then you move station to station to station, and the screens in front of the class guide you, right? Here's what I'm thinking. Here's what happened this week, right? Wellmania and Netflix teamed up with F45 to come up with this Wellmania-themed workout. And it was the weirdest thing because it was just Celeste Barber with the demo person showing how to work the exercise itself. And then she's like doing these like weird activities and she's like flailing about and whatever because she's making fun of people who work out, which is kind of weird, right? Why would you make fun of people who are working out during a workout class? But anyway, and then the class ended with a meditation and it was just her going, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. And then she falls asleep. And we're like, I guess that's comedy. But it didn't. It fell flat.
We're here to work. We're here to work out.
Yeah. What was intriguing to me, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, is that it seems to be a new business model for at least F45. Can you imagine if Barry's Bootcamp, Orange Theory, they all started showing you these ads?
It's
while
they're
you were
ads.
Working out.
They're ads. They're partnered ads, basically.
Yeah. They definitely had to have been paid by Netflix. So it's like, okay, I guess that's the new
way.
What if Peloton?
Yeah.
What if Peloton was like, during your treadmill workout, here's, you know, Ding Tai Fung dumplings. I don't know. I think
RIP Ding Tai Fung guy.
RIP. Yeah. Right? Like there's another avenue. Your eyeballs are always going
to
be
strong. Like hell, Sherlyn. This sounds like I sign up to do this one thing. I have 45 minutes to really empower myself and make myself strong. And I got to watch a Netflix ad for a stupid TikToker show.
Yeah. And it was
I would be furious.
Cringe.
Oh, yeah. My God. Mm-hmm. Did they warn you or did they just start playing this?
We knew something different was happening because the class name on our apps was
and they
different.
Locked all the doors. Yeah.
Well, our trainers were there with us and they didn't, you know, they supported us through it all. It was good.
They should give it, that class should be free. Like, to be honest, if they're going to do that, that class should be free for that week.
This is true.
True. Anything else you want to mention, Sherlyn?
I'm good. Sorry about that.
It's okay. That's good. I'm glad I asked about F45 because there are all these things I have to learn. I need to just like get out the house and be able to do a run.
Helps.
Like, I just need to do things. Anyway. Yeah. Let's talk about pop culture because I can at least sit at night and watch things. That's easier for me. I reviewed Apple's Tetris movie. That's the reason we had that interview at the beginning of this episode. It's fine. I think it's fine, but it's messy. And it's kind of I could see why a lot of the tech press and a lot of people are just like straight up trashing this movie, because I think tonally it is all over the place. If you look at the trailer for it, it seems like a fun, you know, Soviet era spy romp about Tetris. And that's kind of what it was, like getting the rights of Tetris. It was a game created by Alexei Pajitnov in the USSR, like in Moscow at that time. And it was not easy to get stuff out of there. And this one guy, Henk Rogers, a Dutch-Indonesian businessman who was based out of Japan. He was also known for making Japan's first like RPG is a thing. So this guy's really interesting. And I got to, you know, we talked with both of them. They're both like super, super like smart folks. But Henk Rogers he encountered the game during CES. And I was like, oh, you're just like us. You found a thing at CES and you got obsessed with it. And this was like CES, like in the mid 80s, you know?
Okay, like I was
like, far before your time, Sherlyn.
Tetris at CES? Okay.
Tetris at CES. CES has been around for a while. But anyway, he licensed it from one company. And it turns out, after a certain amount of time, it turns out like the company he licensed it from, I'm trying to get the name of it now, did not actually have the Spectrum Holobyte. Spectrum Holobyte initially thought it had the rights to Tetris in America. He licensed that, and turns out, no. And the person that sold to Hollow Byte those rights basically just had a fax from like the Soviet government saying, yeah, we will think about licensing it to you, but it was not an agreement. So this movie does kind of cover that, and I think that part of it is kind of interesting because it involves like British billionaires who also like had certain rights to it, and were one of the guys like Roger... Is it Roger Maxwell? Roger Maxwell or Robert Maxwell? One of the Maxwells. Robert Maxwell is a British billionaire, and his like he is known for like I think stealing a bunch of money, and his whole empire crumbled. But he went to Mikhail Gorbachev to finagle the rights to Tetris. You know, at the same time that Hank Rogers was kind of managing it. It is a really interesting story. You know, it also involves the debut of the Game Boy. There's a scene in this movie where Hank Rogers enters a room. He signs an NDA. Somebody playing Howard Lincoln, former, you know, Nintendo of America president, is there. And they pull off a veil of something. It's just a Game Boy connected to, like, a debug unit. And it's like, it is treated like this holy thing. It's like they're approaching the Holy Grail. And it's like, yeah, that is probably what the Game Boy was like if you first encountered it in the 80s. So there are some things I kind of like about this. And there is some like inherent drama here. I just feel like this movie tries so hard to be like a spy thing too. Like there's a car chase. There was never a car chase. There was like a Russian spy who was sort of like trying to romantically frame Hank Rogers. That never happened. We didn't need all this because the actual history is kind of compelling on its own. This movie also tries too hard. There's like pixel graphics everywhere. Stylistically, I feel like it just doesn't really settle on what it wants to be, but it is entertaining. Now, I think some people will be fine with it. There was one movie reviewer who had admitted in his review that he had never heard of Tetris before.
Whoa, what? I think
the entire internet was like, who are you? Are you an alien from another planet?
Not to be ageist, how old was this person?
No, he's an older guy. So Pete Hammond from Deadline, his subject line or headline for this movie is Taron Egerton is sensational in video game origin story that plays like a nail-biting Cold War spy thriller. He admitted to never hearing about Tetris before. And I feel like a lot of people were just like, who are you? How is there a rock you live under? Is there like a hyperbaric chamber that you just like emerge from to review movies once in a while, but never actually engage with any other culture? Tetris is a pretty big deal. I think this movie, at the very least, understands that Tetris is a big deal. I think it could have been so much more. There are other things you could look at. And maybe, you know, my main takeaway is if this gets people more interested in the broader impact of Tetris and what the game means. I like Tetris. I've played a lot of Tetris. There's a BBC documentary called Tetris from Russia with Love. That is very, very good. Dan Ackerman, the CNET reporter, wrote a book called The Tetris Effect. And there's also a graphic novel called The Games People Play that I've heard really good things about.
I've heard that one. Yeah.
There are like so many other ways to engage with the Tetris origins. I'm just sad that this movie didn't quite hit it. I would have loved like a Halt and Catch Fire style version of the Tetris story. And that's a show for you, by the way, Sherlyn. I don't know if you've watched any yet.
Heard of
but
it.
I really like. Yeah. I really like Halt and Catch Fire. Get past that wonky first season because it gets really good. But yeah, Tetris just doesn't really hit those marks. So there's that. Also, briefly, just wanted to mention Ted Lasso is back. I forget if we've mentioned it. And Shrinking, the other show from the Ted Lasso creator. They're both on Apple TV+. They're both very, very good. And I would recommend Shrinking to you, Sherlyn, because it's entirely about a therapist and kind of
I was going to talk about it this week too, and then I saw you had dropped it, and that's why I had to scramble to like find the Instagram.
It's okay.
Yes, you're
right.
Yeah.
You're digging it?
Yeah, go on. It's been on my list. I've been putting off my Apple TV stuff, like especially Ted Lasso and Shrinking. I was going to watch it last night and talk about it today, but I can't because I had stuff I was doing. I told you I went to bed at 3 because I was still working. Julio and Julio, our live stream producer, says that him and his wife could not finish the season after having given Shrinking a shot. It might not be for everyone. Yeah. It's definitely something that I am interested in because it's about shrinking. Yes.
It's about therapists and sort of also the problems therapists themselves can have. But also, I think it's a very sweet show about friends helping each other like get past grief and a father trying to reconnect with their daughter. It is It is compelling, but it's more like a dramedy. It's more like a comedy that is really dramatic at times, sort of like Ted Lasso, actually. But it doesn't have the sort of like, the main character is not Ted Lasso, right? The main character is not this like super happy, really positive American guy. The main character is Jason Segel, and he's kind of a dumpy, sad dude, which is a character he plays quite a bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As he usually plays. Did you ever see Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Yes. Fairly recently, too.
I love that movie. I think it's one of the best like rom-coms made in the last decade. It's very, very sweet. So anyway, Ted Lasso and Trinking, both very good. I forgot to mention this, but John Wick 4 is out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've heard, Chilin, but our boy, we've talked about him before, Donnie Yen, plays a central role amazing. In John Wick 4. And he's so good. He is so good. It is so good to have Donnie Yen on American screens. He's 60 years old. And he's still kicking ass. Love it.
I like that. There was this story I heard about him having had to convince the Star Wars movie producers to make his character less of a trope. And I thought that was really nice of him to stand up for that. Yeah,
I love it. And also weird that he is once again playing a blind warrior. He's playing a blind assassin, John Wick 4. But they do so many good things with it. Guys, if you like action... If you want like the greatest action experience of your life, Sherlyn, I think you'll appreciate this because you like Hong Kong action movies too. This movie is like 3 hours long of pure bliss. Just pure, unadulterated. Oh my God, I don't know how they did this. Somebody just fell down 200 stairs. I don't know how any of this was made. It is a beautiful film. It's a wonderful film. And it's practically perfect. So yeah, check out John Wick 4, everybody.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, at Devendra at Mastodon.social on the Elephant site, and I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at TheFilmcast.com.
If you need me, I am at Sherlyn Low on Twitter, but today I will plug my Instagram because I might be less and less active on Twitter, and my Instagram is just Sherlynstagram because I'm smart. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and subscribe on anything to get podcasts. Choo, like not choo choo, that's a train. Beep beep, vroom vroom.